Yeah, so we're on chapter 36 of Numbers, and this is an interesting chapter to kind of conclude the book with, you know, because it has to do once again with the land. So everything in these closing chapters is having to do with the land, having to get the people of God kind of prepped and ready and in the right minds. And so, but you know, as you're thinking about where God is taking you and the plans He has for you, the promises that He's made, inevitably, you know, if you're a thinking person, you can kind of come to some questions of your own. And you can even think up of the what ifs, the unknowns, the complications of life, like where you don't know what to do in certain circumstances, or you can see issues that could arise, and you're wanting to know what Lord, what do I do here? And and that's kind of what happens in this last chapter. So this chapter, there's a couple of features that I want us to just kind of zero in on. The first feature is we end where we began, which is just a total grace of God thing. The first 10 chapters began with notes of obedience, where there was this repeated emphasis on the fact that the people did everything that the Lord had commanded them, that Moses did everything that the Lord commanded them. And there's this repeated just theme throughout the first part of the book on that. And so it kind of sets you up for this shock of chapter 11 when suddenly there's grumbling and complaining from the people who were doing everything that the Lord had asked. And so you're saying, who is these people? Did they get switched out for somebody else? And so that's all part of the setup that Moses has to rhetorically shock us into, no, things, there are circumstances and trials and pressures in life that bring out the human heart. And that's what happens. Like, it's, you know, when they're camped out at Sinai and they're going through all of this and everything is good, you have this theme of they did everything that the Lord asked. They did everything that the Lord asked. And then, but as soon as they leave and the pressures of life come, right? The pressures of going through the wilderness. And all of a sudden, it's those kind of things that come out that bring out who people really are. It's trials that show us our hearts. And that's what happened in chapter 11, is it's the circumstances that reveal the heart and show us, this generation isn't who we thought they were. This generation is actually a generation of grumblers and complainers and rebels that culminate in a rejection of the land, rejection of Moses, rejection of God, and a condemnation in the wilderness. But you wouldn't have necessarily expected that fate for them in the first 10 chapters, right? And this is where Moses just very graciously, as he ends this book that could be viewed as just this negative, it's just this negative book. It's all about just Israel's failure and how they died in the wilderness and all that, but what have we been constantly seeing throughout this book? From beginning to end, the real theme is what? Can you put your finger on the real theme of Numbers? God's grace, yeah. Grace that despite people's fickleness and sin and failures, God's grace permeates it all. It overshadows everything. So that even the failure of people can't nullify the grace and the promises of God. God's promises endure. And so Israel, as hard-hearted as they were, as rebellious as they were, everything that they did, that generation died, but God's promises remain, right? And that's why there's a first census, And then you have the census of the second generation. After the first generation has completely died in the wilderness, you have a second generation, and God has basically replaced the numbers. They're basically a one-to-one match, because first generation can't cancel out God's promises. God is going to bring his people into the land, and their fickleness and rebellion isn't going to cancel that out. They didn't get to experience the joys and the benefits and the privileges of that land, but God's promises didn't end because of their sin. God's promises endured, and God was faithful in bringing his people into the land. Even when they are unaware of what's going on in the midst of rebellion, God's grace is seen as he's protecting them from a pagan prophet for hire who's been hired to curse them, and instead he only allows Balaam to do what? Bless them. To bless them seven times. And to pronounce the coming king and the coming kingdom that will spell the judgment of anyone who stands opposed to Israel. And that's happening in the midst of their rebellion, right before their final culminating rebellion, where they turn to immorality and paganism in the worship of Baal at Peor. That's God's grace. That God's grace is just, it's uncancelable. It's uncancelable because it's sovereign grace. And here at this last chapter, Moses wants to highlight the fact that where we started at is where we're ending at. We're ending at highlighting the fact that God's people are obedient once again. And you see this emphasis throughout here. And I just want to read you the opening section here, because it starts out with a problem. It starts out with a group of people who are going, you know, as we're anticipating the entrance into the land, there's a complicating factor that threatens the unity of God's people. And Moses gives an answer, and the Lord really gives an answer to the issue that solves the unity problem and highlights God's grace and highlights the obedience of his people. So this is verse 1. The heads of the fathers' houses of the clan of the people of Gilead, the son of Machir, son of Manasseh. Okay, so you to trace all that back. So we're talking about the tribe of Manasseh, right? Who, and then it says from the clans of the people of Joseph. So, you know, Joseph, Manasseh, and then one of the sons of Manasseh, the you could call it a clan, Machir. And then of the people of Gilead, so that's a specific portion of the tribe of Manasseh that, remember, you're going back to a few chapters earlier when they requested, hey, you know, we're with Reuben and Gad, we've got a lot of cattle, and we would rather have our inheritance be on the east side of the Jordan rather than cross over and have our inheritance be over there. We're just looking at this going, there's wide open plains. This is a great place for herds. And so they joined in, this portion of Manasseh, this particular half of the half tribe of Manasseh is settled over there. But they're bringing this issue. They say they came near and spoke before Moses and before the chiefs, the heads of the fathers' houses of the people of Israel. So this is a big deal. They're approaching. This is a formal engagement, and this is kind of public. Verse 2, they said, Yahweh commanded my Lord to give the land for inheritance by lot to the people of Israel, and my Lord was commanded by Yahweh to give the inheritance as Zelophehad, our brother, to his daughters. Okay, now we're combining like two different chapters here. Do you remember? We're going all the way back. we're hearing from something that happened back in, I believe it was chapter 32. And then we're also going back to chapter 27, back to verses 1 through 11 of chapter 27, when there was an issue that arose with the daughters of Zelophehad, who was, he was a man who was, he didn't die in the rebellion of Korah, but he died for his own sins, but he had five daughters and no sons. And up until that point, the only legal, expressed legal way in which land and property was inherited was from the father to the son. Well, he doesn't have any sons, so what happens? I mean, you have a potential catastrophe with this family, and the daughters are coming and approaching and going, hey, here's the potential disaster. There is nobody to give the land to under the current situation, and so in that case, our family will just get nothing. Then there will be no land, no property that will have the name Zelophehad on it, basically, because we can't inherit it. And so Moses goes, this isn't okay. You have a legitimate issue. I don't have a word about this myself. I've got to go to the Lord and ask him what should we do. And basically, the Lord goes, yeah, they have a great point. This is the grace of God in how he sometimes he works with people in the fog that they're in, and he gives them revelation as they need it, rather than just giving it all the way up front of this is what's supposed to happen if you do this, and this is the formation of what we would call case law. We have case law in the United States, right? So we have base laws, and then we have situations that come up that challenge, like how do we interpret this particular statute in this case? And then that becomes a precedent that other people can say, well, hey, the precedent has set here for how to interpret this law. And so this was a case law study. Okay, now. But this case law came with other ramifications, and that's what's coming up in the last chapter. It's going, whatever happened with the daughters and the case law was, if a man doesn't have any sons, that's the first flow of inheritances to the sons, and then to, you know, uncles and cousins or whatever. But if that can't happen, then the daughters can receive that inheritance so that the property can stay within the family name, okay? And so that's how it was left until now. And now we have another question that arises, okay, but it's not that simple. So he says, verse 2, Yahweh commanded my Lord, that's Moses, to give the land for inheritance by lot to the people of Israel. My Lord was commanded by Yahweh to give the inheritance of Zelophehad, our brother, to his daughters. Okay? But here is the complication. But if they are married to any of the sons of the other tribes of the people of Israel, then their inheritance will be taken from the inheritance of our fathers and added to the inheritance of the tribe into which they marry. So it will be taken away from the lot of our inheritance. And when the jubilee of the people of Israel comes, then their inheritance will be added to the inheritance of the tribe into which they marry. And their inheritance will be taken from the inheritance of the tribe of our father. So I don't know if you're following that or not, but here's the complication is, the daughters inheriting the land solved only one issue, that the land, at least for a time, stayed in the father's tribe and in the father's name. But it didn't solve an ultimate issue, and that was if those daughters then marry someone outside of the tribe of Manasseh, legal standing says that that inheritance now belonged to the husband. So now you have this thing set where, okay, so I hesitate to, okay, Jordae is a daughter of Zelophehad. I'm not going to call myself a daughter of Zelophehad. Okay? So she has inherited some of her father's property because it's just her and her four sisters, and so it's in her name, okay? But then she marries someone from the tribe of Reuben, okay? Law says that that land that is in her name now belongs to her husband. And now that land has been transferred out of Manasseh, the inheritance that had been allotted or that had apportioned by lot to the tribe of Manasseh, and now Reuben gets more land than Manasseh had. And Manasseh has lost inheritance. And so the solution of the solving of one issue raised another issue. Okay? And this is how life works sometimes. Life isn't always like just clean and neat. And sometimes it is, but sometimes there are things that happen and that were decisions that have to be made because we live in a fallen world, and there's things that happen, like people die before they have sons. And so, you know, life isn't always pretty. And so a solution at this end runs up to ramifications at this end. And now, this doesn't surprise God at all, but it certainly surprised the people. And they're seeing this and they're going, wait a minute, we just received this land, but we know that as soon as they get married, if they marry somebody outside the tribe, we lose the land. And that, and God has always, God has talked about and promised that each tribe is going to get an allotment, and now we're going to lose an allotment if they were to marry outside the tribe. So how is this fair? How is this right? This is the potential to do what?
Lose all the land.
Say that again?
I just said lose all their land.
To lose all the land. But what's the social ramification? Like what's...
Disunity.
I mean, that's the biggest issue here, is that there is a potential for infighting and disunity among the people of God, and God cares too much about unity to allow that to happen. So something has to happen. Okay. I had another hand that was up a second ago. Oh, go ahead. Yeah, that's who it was.
It says back here in 2.
In chapter 2 or in verse 2?
Verse 2.
Okay.
Inheritance by lot.
Yeah.
Shake of the dice?
Yep. So it was apportioned, but it was given by lot. And so there was a way, there was a sense in which each family was having to trust the Lord in his providence. So it was basically its providence.
Yeah.
You had to trust that God was going to be fair through this process. Yeah. But it seemed... Yeah, and bigger tribes, bigger families, right? If you had a family of 10, you're not going to get the same amount of land as the family of 2, right? But at the same time, it was by lot. So you're like, I've really got to trust the Lord in his equity here, that he's going to be kind here. Yeah.
So did each of the tribes get an area that was geographically defined?
Yeah. Correct. Yeah. Yeah. So there was multiple senses of division there.
It's interesting that geographic area. I don't know, it's just interesting that they were having trouble with like, okay, there's a square patch.
Right.
Right.
That's what they're concerned about. Yeah, and they're bringing this to Moses. They're doing exactly what they should. They're going, we've just received our inheritance, but we're drawing lines and we're making connections here of the what ifs that need to be dealt with before they become an issue. Right? It's always better to deal with things at that point rather than after when the issue arises. But this is a big deal.
Well, at least it shows that people were paying attention and being proactive rather than waiting until it already happened.
Right.
They were listening.
Exactly. Yeah, and they were going and they were presenting this case before Moses and before the elders. And I mean, there's even an issue, there's a question in verse 4 you know, when it comes to the year of Jubilee, who's going to own the land, right? Remember, at the year of Jubilee, every 70 years, you know, the trumpet's blown and all of the land that had been, had to be sold and away and given away for the, you know, to, let's say I run into hard times and I have to sell my land to somebody else in order to pay off my debts or whatever, or maybe there's a famine and so now I don't own my land anymore. And but the year of Jubilee ensured that in the end, that was only going to be a temporary thing, that that there was a grand reset in the land where all that land got reverted back. And so, but there's a question here. It's like, okay, so they marry someone from Reuben. Now the husband is a Reubenite, and now the land belongs to him. At the year of Jubilee, what happens? Does the land stay with them? Is it now their permanent land, or does it get reverted back to Manasseh? Because if it gets reverted back to Manasseh, now you've got a Reubenite living on Manasseh's land. I mean, it's a mess, right? It's a mess. So what do we do? What do we do? Verse 5. Moses commanded the people of Israel according to the word of Yahweh. Okay? In every other time that this has happened, by the way, Moses has said, I'm not sure what to do. Let me go ask the Lord. I think implied here is that he did the same thing. It's just that they've cut that part out, and let me tell you what the Lord has said. Okay? So there is a sense in which Moses is he's not flying by the seat of his pants. He's hearing from the Lord, and he's making a command to deal with this specific issue and basically to develop case law. It says, Moses commanded, verse 5, the people of Israel, according to the word of Yahweh, saying, and here's the solution, the tribe of the people of Joseph is right. This is what Yahweh commands concerning the daughters of Zelophehad. Let them marry whom they think best. Only they shall marry within the clan of the tribe of their father. And there it is. The inheritance of the people of Israel shall not. So that's the solution to the issue. And then undergirding that is the principle, which is articulated in verse 7. The inheritance of the people of Israel shall not be transferred from one tribe to another. For every one of the people of Israel shall hold on to the inheritance of the tribe of his fathers. And every daughter who possesses an inheritance in any tribe of the people of Israel shall be wife to one of the clan of the tribe of her father, so that every one of the people of Israel may possess the inheritance of his fathers. So no inheritance, once again, doubling down, restating it for emphasis, no inheritance shall be transferred from one tribe to another, for each of the tribes of the people of Israel shall hold on to its own inheritance. So there's a number of things going on here. Number one, you have this repeated emphasis on the fact that the importance of the land being owned by those who inherited it. So you're getting a sense of the significance of land, the significance of the gift of God. It's not to be taken lightly. It's not to be transferred willy-nilly. It's not to be, here's the sense. This is where God is, obviously not everybody is going to face the circumstance, but we don't know what God's lot is for our lives, right? I can't explain to you why you were born into the family that you were born into, and raised in the house that you were raised in the town, in the city, in the country that you live in. I can't explain to you why you're an American citizen and why you're not why you didn't grow up in Somalia facing hardship. I can't explain that to you. That's the providence of God. I can't explain your lot in life. And what God calls each one of us to do is to, rather than kind of see ourselves as and kind of have this sense of I'm a victim of my circumstances, I'm a victim, like like the world is against me. Instead, this is where God has me for whatever reason. And for a daughter of whatever his name was, starts with a Z, can't pronounce it, Zelophehad. If you're a daughter of Zelophehad and you've got these sisters and you know that they're a blessing, but you don't have, there's no sons, and so in this sense, you have this obligation now. You have this limitation put on your life, and it's not the world's fault. It's God's providential circumstance for your life. And this is how God is requiring every one of us in our own circumstance to kind of order our priorities around what is pleasing to the Lord. And so, you know, if you're one of these daughters and you know I have an obligation, I have a duty that goes beyond just marry the person that I want to marry. Now it is, I can marry anyone as long as it's within the clan of the tribe of Manasseh. And rather than seeing that as, man, I'm just a victim of circumstance and I'm just like, oh, woe is me. Instead, it's the responsibility that in the same way that God calls every one of us, whether or not you're a man or a woman, to take on the responsibility of a man or a woman, right? And so if you're a man, you are called to something. You were called to be a husband, to be a father, if that's what the Lord... Like, you're called to these things. You're not called to that as a woman. But if you're a woman, you're called to womanhood and what that brings into your life and what the Lord allows you to do with that. And that's part of the providence of God. But that means that each one of us are having to make decisions that we know based in the providence of God with the priorities of God. And so in this case, these daughters are having to prioritize the gift of God of the land in their family as a factor in their pleasure of being married to a man. And they're having to make decisions where these two things now affect each other. Why does it not affect everybody else? That's beyond I can't answer that. But I know this is where God has them. This is where God has me. This is where God has you. And we have circumstances that are all unique, but we're having to make decisions where our goal is to please the Lord. And our goal is to live within the providence of God. And that's what this is. It's a window into living within the providence of God in your life. And yeah, there can be limitations, but we can also live with joy within that window of providence. Yeah. Well, if she didn't have property, yes, yeah.
And it says that these five would be free to choose.
Right.
But they're only free to choose because they don't have a father who would choose for them. And because they have property,
correct,
that gives them the freedom to choose.
Right, yeah, so there, and this is something we saw in chapter 27, that there was a level of autonomy and freedom that these women had that in that particular society, they might not have had.
Right, because they had property.
Well, and because they did not have a father. Normally, the authority over them would be transferred from... Right, right. But it wouldn't have been they didn't have a father, but they also didn't have anybody else, because the land wouldn't have passed to them if there was an uncle or a brother or something like that. But that's just showing you that this is, number one, this is not going to be a wide... circumstance that was going to just happen once every year or something like it's that this was but that this is putting a filling a hole in an issue that is potentially divisive.
And
yeah.
Those kinsmen who could have a claim, are they all like in Boaz, the kinsmen,
Not necessarily. Because that would be more if she married and then the husband died, then he would take on the wife. Yeah, and that was to redeem the property. Yeah. Somebody else.
Well, I was just thinking, it's possible that one of those young ladies rebelled and married someone from another tribe, in which case you would assume that her land would not be.
True. And who knows what the circumstances are? That's a question.
Ladies that do things,
right? But not these ladies. And do you know why I know that? Because of verse 10.
Okay.
You remember how I said like this chapter ends the way that the whole it ends with a note of obedience, a joyful obedience. Verse 10: the daughters of Zelophehad did as Yahweh commanded Moses, for Mahla, Tirzah, Hogla, Milcah and Noah, the daughters of Zelophehad, were married to sons of their father's brothers. They were married into the clans of the people of Manasseh, the son of Joseph, and their inheritance remained in the tribe of their father's clan. So it ends on a note of whatever potential there was, not in this case.
It could happen again.
But then you're dealing with somebody who's breaking an express commandment. And that's different than it began with a question of there is a hole in the law that doesn't address this circumstance. What do we do? Because the potential is great for division if we don't figure this out. Now the hole is patched. And so if you break the law, now you're a lawbreaker. Now, go at your own risk, right? What the consequences of that would be, I'm not entirely sure that they're not stated what the consequences would be for, but it could be. Within the clan of the tribe of Manasseh. Right. Yeah. Yeah. So there's, right. Okay. So it ends with a great, very fittingly with a note of obedience. The MacArthur Study Bible put this. It says that the daughters of Zelophehad exemplified the obedience of God's commands that they should have been practiced by all of Israel. Their inheritance was a direct result of their obedience to the Lord, a basic lesson stressed throughout the whole book of Numbers. That blessing comes from obedience. So there's just a happy note at the very end. It's like whatever the dark, hand that is laid on this book in the middle chapters. By the end of it, there's this bright light of new generation, new day, and obedience and faithfulness that's going on, blessing as they're inheriting the land of their father. It's beautiful, and it does underscore the fact that God cares about unity in His people. So he cared about dealing with this issue. He cared about clarifying the issue so that there would be unity rather than a potential for disunity. He also is calling us to kind of prioritize our life according to what the Lord has called us to and the circumstances that He's called us to, and that's another thing we see. I do want to note that the book ends with a very clear note of Mosaic authorship. Verse 13: these are the commandments and the rules that Yahweh commanded through what? Moses, to the people of Israel in the plains of Moab by the Jordan at Jericho. It's a perfect setup for Deuteronomy, but it's also a close to say this was dictated to and recorded by Moses himself. It's an answer to all the challenges to, Moses couldn't have wrote it because it was a product of the 7th century or a product of the post-exilic period or whatever. It's very clear in this as well as other chapters that Moses wrote it. But as we come to the end of the book of Deuteronomy, like what are some big lessons and some big themes that you have taken away from this book? I know you've kind of hit it off and on. Not everybody is here for every single one, except for me. I don't know what your problem is. I've been here for all of Numbers. Yeah. There it is. Yeah. If you say that again, sir. Yeah, the promises of God are irrevocable. You can't bend God to your will. He bends you to His. Right. Yeah, you do kind of see the consequences of rebellion and disbelief and disobedience, and then you see the consequences of obedience. And so, it's not the only way to be right with God is to obey Him. No, there's been grace, but at the same time, the means of blessing is through listening to the Lord and following His commands. Right. Yeah. Because they had been allotted the land. Remember, this is on the east side of the Jordan. So right. The half tribe of Manasseh already had their land. It's just everybody else is just like, man. Yeah, that'll happen in Joshua 20. But the three tribes on the east side of the Jordan already had their land. You know, one thing I was thinking about is just we saw this, or did you have something?
Well, I was just looking. There's a lot of bad stuff that happened in Numbers.
Yes, there was. Yeah.
Aaron and Miriam
yep.
They went and looked at the land and came back and said, no. Stoned for not observing the Sabbath. Korah rebels.
Yep.
Kinds of bad stuff.
Lots and lots of stuff. It culminates in gross pagan immorality, and 24,000 are killed.
That's all I was going to say. There's just lots of stuff.
Yeah.
Lots of things in Numbers.
And yet, at the same time, you have basically the same amount of people at the beginning and the end. And you weren't here all the time. You got it. One kind of thing that we've seen it again and again, that's just a good reminder to us, is when there is question in life, when there are like answers that we don't have that we need, what did they do? They came to Moses. They presented the issue. He sought the Lord's direction, and out of that came clarity. And it reminds me of James chapter 1. If any of you, James 1:5, lacks wisdom, let him ask God, who gives generously to all without reproach, and it will be given him. But let him ask in faith with no doubting. For the one who doubts is like a wave of the sea that is driven and tossed by the wind. For that person must not suppose that he will receive anything from the Lord. He is a double-minded man, unstable in all his ways. So there's just a sense in which what James is talking about is what we've seen exemplified by people throughout the book of Numbers. When there is questions, when we don't have the answers that we need to issues like what happens if they marry outside the tribe, instead of running to man's wisdom, we run and we seek the wisdom of God. And God promises that He gives generously. He will provide wisdom. If we ask in faith, if we ask in confidence that He will provide wisdom for us, He'll give it. But we have to be confident in Him. We can't doubt. We can't rely on our own. That's just that came up again and again and again in this book. What else? So we kind of close out. Yeah. Yeah. Right.
He had lots of chances.
Yep.
Didn't he say something about thinking Moses one time and already
does a certain
Israelite
youth? Yep. But he didn't. Yep. Well, and we've seen Moses change throughout this book too. I mean, man, there were times where he doubted, times where he just lamented even being put in this circumstance, you know. And the Lord gave him opportunities to, and tests for his own character where, you know, I'll get rid of them and raise you up instead. And then Moses responds to the test in obedience as the mediator that he's supposed to be. How can you do this? Because he cares more about the character of God than he does his own personal ambition. And but at the same time, you see him fail in chapter 20. You see him get angry and allow his anger to override his own desire to see God glorified. So he glorifies himself and ends up paying the price for it. He's not exempt, by the way, from the judgment of God because he's Moses. He doesn't get to see the land either, so God isn't showing him favoritism at all. He chose him sovereignly for his own purposes, but it's not because of Moses. It was because God had purposes for him, but he's not exempted from consequences. And he even carries kind of the gun shyness of all of his past experiences, all of the first generation he carries into it, so that when we see Gad and Reuben ask for the land on the other side, and it seems like it's as innocent of a request, but he's going, "You're being just like your fathers, and God's going to judge you." And then like, whoa, wait a minute. We just... Yeah, like we'll go across. We have no intention of not helping out the rest of the tribes. But Moses has seen this movie before, and it's like I see what could happen here, and you might not even know your own hearts, but he's been affected by this whole thing. And he knows he's at the end of his life, but he does not want to happen to this generation what happened to the previous one. I mean, it just you see him change. You see the death of his sister and his brother and the end of an era. There's just lots. There's lots of change that happened in this book. But the constancy is what? It's the Lord. And that is, no matter what book you're in, that's the ultimate main character of any of the stories of the Old Testament is the Lord, is God. He is the unchanging God. His character never changes. His righteous standard never changes. And he is the standard by which we judge the actions and the thoughts and the words of people throughout the whole of the Old Testament and all of the books that we read. And he's the same. He begins with a plan to bless his people. He blesses them despite their sin. And then he has reconstituted them with the new generation ready to go in and receive the inheritance, the blessing that he has prepared for them, that they should have been their parents. But he hasn't gotten rid of them because he's gracious and he's compassionate and he loves his people. I mean, it's been a constant throughout. And that's an encouragement to me that my ups and downs in life, they don't go up and down with God. You know, he's not fickle and he's not, his personality doesn't change. He's constant. Anyway, it's been a privilege to go through the book, and we are done. Let me pray as we close. Thank you, Lord, for this book. Thank you for its testimony to us of just your love for your people, your grace that is not able to be conquered, not able to be canceled, not able to be neutralized, even by the very people that you make your promises to. But you work in hearts, and you work in circumstances, you work in history. You test us by taking us into circumstances that where we have to make choices about whether or not we are going to trust the Lord and we're going to rely on his word, or we're going to trust our own intuition, our own wisdom, and then complain because we feel like we're victims of circumstances or victims of God, and you give us those choices so that we can prove out our faith. That's what James tells us too. That as we come through those challenges and those trials, we come out on the other side with a more hardened, fervent joy because our faith has been proven to be alive and true and real and stronger on the other end. And you care about making us stronger, care about demonstrating the genuineness of our faith. And so I thank you, Lord, that we are never alone, that you are always with us, even when we feel alone, and that the circumstances that we do find ourselves in and the providential arrangements of our lives are also opportunities and tests for our faith and for our priorities. And I pray, like the daughters of Zelophehad, whose limitations and whose choices in life might might be lamentable, no brothers, responsible for things that they didn't think that they would have to be responsible for, limited in who they could marry, and at the same time they rejoiced to obey the Lord and embraced the limitations for the joy of walking in obedience to you, and they experience the blessing of that, of those decisions of obedience. And I just thank you, Lord, that that's the testimony of how this book ends, with five faithful women that experience the joy of obedience and the blessings that flow from it. May that be true of each one of us, Lord, in Jesus' name. Amen.